Online Trading Academy is a leader in investing and stock trading education. Sign up for a class today and learn proven strategies on how to trade smarter. Text Curley, C-U-R-L-E-Y, to 57682 and register for a free workshop in Bellevue and other surrounding areas. Text Curley, C-U-R-L-E-Y, to 57682.
Welcome to the Tom and Curley Show. That's right, I'm Tom Tangney, and if you're hearing my voice first, that usually means that John Curley is out raising money for a good cause somewhere else. John will not be here today. However, he has promised us, we'll keep checking in with producer Andrew to see if he indeed has sent us the news quiz. So the news quiz we're still planning on doing today, John has promised to write a great one for us. We'll get to that at 11:30. But so, if John isn't here, I'm here. Who else could possibly be wasting his Friday morning with me? But let's hear it. It's Mr. Paranoia himself, Andrew Walsh from the world-famous Too Beautiful to Live podcast. Welcome aboard, Andrew.
Thanks, man. I couldn't remember you. I thought maybe I was Flagpole Sitta. Who's Flagpole
Sitta?
Yeah,
that's me too. That's you. That's the beginning of that.
Oh, that is the song. Yeah. Okay, good. I'll accept that. I want to hit you right off with Paranoia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. So that is the right song. Yes. Good. I've been looking forward to it. That's how they got me in here this morning. I told you this is the first time I've woken up before 10 a.m., I think, since I turned 40. So happy to be here and happy to see the morning.
You know, you're a role model for a lot of people because a lot of people don't get to be 40 and still live the life of a teenager.
Yeah, no, that's a real thing. Yeah, no, kids, be like me. Grow up so you can sleep until 10. That's what
exactly all the
parents want.
And I think the most important thing for us, because I think there's a kind of a simpatico between us, we have both co-hosted talk shows with the one and only John Curley.
Yeah, yeah, no, we actually have a support group for it. If anybody else out there has co-hosted a show with John Curley, hit me up.
Please.
We don't use last names, though.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we're really happy that you're here, Andrew. It's always a fun, and we'll have to check in with you about how Too Beautiful to Live and Luke Burbank and that whole world is going for you. But first, I assume that you've been following the news quite closely. This has been an incredible week of local activism on both sides of the head tax issue. The head tax issue has dominated, I guess, politics for maybe about 10 days here locally. It's been kicking around for about 2 or 3, 4, 5 months maybe now. I think right before the end of the year, the city council decided to postpone a vote on the head tax. They came up with something that they were finally going to go for, and they got a majority of the city council, 5 out of the 9 members, to say they were going to back it. And then this happened literally on our show. I think we got a little notice from a Seattle Times article, I think by Briar Dudley, the business reporter, who just mentioned, oh, by the by, Amazon's decided to put a pause on all their construction of a new building and to maybe sublease out the Rainier Square office space that they had done in reaction to the head tax. And ever since then, this has been dominating the news. And today's morning edition has established that Mayor Durkan has come up with what she thinks is a compromise. I think this is a good thing, but I'm interested in getting your particular take. The head tax, there's no head tax, no head tax. We've heard chanted by a number of construction union members and the business community. Seattle Chamber of Commerce has been against it. Jenny Durkan has decided to take it and cut it in half. She is proposing about half the size of the original head tax and seems to think that that is going to appease both sides, perhaps. We don't know if it will or not. But right now, the word is Starbucks. We're going to talk about Starbucks, but the word is that Amazon has agreed to maybe go along with this. This is Monty Anderson, the executive secretary of the building trades. He was the one who was, helping lead the attack on the head tax, the protest union head, throwing in trade union support for the mayor's compromise head tax proposal. Again, this is Monty Anderson.
The head tax, as proposed originally, obviously had a lot of negative connotations, had a huge job loss for the Seattle building trades. So to get Amazon on board and have them give me a call and tell me they're going to restart construction is excellent news. I mean, Anytime you get a call from an end user or an employer that says they're going to keep and retain hundreds of millions of dollars worth of work, that's a good, it's good news.
Okay, so what Jenny Durkin, the new mayor, has decided is that she says, or what she's announced, she has four of the nine council members on board with her proposal. There is a finance committee meeting now. We'll have Mike Lewis covering that for us in the news department. We'll see if there's any movement on that. And I guess the question is this enough to convince one of the five council members who are in favor of the heavier head tax to switch sides because it's a compromise? How do you see this, Andrew Walsh? Do you see this as a sellout that that Mayor Durkin is kind of selling the cause for the head tax out by coming up with a compromise? Do you think this is a wise administrative move? Or do you think that the Amazons of the world should hold to the no head tax philosophy and not allow for any tax?
I'm sorry, what's a head tax? I told you it's early. No, I joke. I don't think it's a sellout. I don't think looking for compromise, if you're a politician or anybody who's trying to find a solution to a huge problem like this, I wouldn't call this a sellout. Yeah. I am somebody who would be a proponent of the original.
You are, okay.
Head tax, if we're going with that terminology.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an employee tax, right?
Yes.
Well, I don't know why I hate the term head tax.
Okay.
I feel like I don't know who came up with that term, but I think it conjures up ideas of kind of headhunting or something negative like that. But I am not somebody who really worries that Amazon is, or the other companies. I mean, this would only affect, for right now, this would only affect companies that have what? Like that bring in $20 million in gross,
yeah. Right.
I think.
Yeah, top 3%. It affects about 500 companies.
Right. And those companies in Seattle, I think, are doing pretty well right now. I don't think this is, despite what you read in the Seattle Times opinion pages and their headlines, I don't think that businesses are really suffering in Seattle these days. Quite the opposite. I think that human beings are living on the streets in Seattle these days, and they're the ones that we need to look out for. And like Councilmember O'Brien has pointed out, I'm always concerned when you have one company or the region's largest employer kind of dictating what our tax policy is going to be. I think that's just generally problematic, but I also understand it's 2018. It doesn't even matter what year it is. This is the way it works. We see it with Boeing. This is the free market. These are the things that we have to kind of work with and around. So the mayor, as I would hope any leader would do, I'm glad to see that she's looking for some sort of compromise. I would put myself in O'Brien's camp.
Though. Okay. So John pulled this stunt yesterday with me. If the head tax comes to a vote, it's not going to, the full council won't vote on it until Monday. But if the vote right now was for the full $75 million head tax, about $500 per employee, would you vote in favor of that? Would you vote in favor of the compromise, or where? How would
I would
you
vote in favor of the original.
You would,
and
okay.
If I understand it correctly, if there are five, I think I'm right about this. There are five council members who are in support of the original plan.
That's right.
But that at would least not pass the veto by the mayor, which you need six votes for. And when I went to bed last night, I know that Sally Bagshaw was the vote that was potentially maybe going to sway over to the original plan side. So if anybody wants to call Sally Bagshaw's office today and maybe propose that she stick with that, I would support that as well.
So you think there's a chance?
I think I would like to see the original plan go through. But again, I am just very uncomfortable with this idea that we give so much power and deference to these companies, and we are so scared. We are so scared that they're going to leave that, you know, we as a society just like get down on our knees and are prostrate in front of these people or these businesses, I should say, because they have so much power over us. And I don't think that should be what we're leading with. And I really think that Amazon can handle this.
This is a breath of fresh air for this show, because normally I'm the one holding
the
down
listeners,
the liberal side of things. And John, of course, is outraged by all of this. So let me just push back a bit on you for the sake of discussion. You mentioned that, well, you know, if you make a $20 million tax on Amazon, it's not going to make a pinch. We did yesterday or the day before, the CEO of Iwajimaya, which is a longtime international district, it's a grocery store, basically. Now, they've come out and they said, no, listen, we're not all Amazons. We're going to get hit by this tax, and it's going to, we are already operating on a thin margin and a tight margin, and that's going to be problematic for us that in, although we're in the
that's
top
good
3%,
context, Tom. Can I tell you that's really interesting? Yes. And I didn't know that because I do picture. I'm sorry to interrupt your flow, but I think that's a really good point because you look at Wajamaya. And it's a unique, very, it feels like a very local company that we all really appreciate.
With heritage.
With heritage and also is kind of irreplaceable as far as I see. So hearing those perspectives, I think, is very informative, which is why, again, I think people should keep an open mind when somebody is looking for a compromise. Sorry, though. Go ahead.
That's fair enough. That's the idea. I was just, the little pushback is there are, not everybody is Amazon.
Yeah.
And the idea, and even with the Amazon principle, Amazon, there have been a lot of, I mean, Amazon, $20 million is nothing to Jeff Bezos, but it's the principle that Jeff Bezos and Amazon and the Chamber of Commerce and all these major corporations feel like they don't want this idea that if we are job creators, as they like to call themselves, if they are responsible for jobs, we shouldn't be penalized by doing something good for the economy. And that's the kind of the countervailing argument.
But it's not
to that.
Penalizing, though. It's doing their fair share. And it's also in this particular case, the fact that this is. They're not all Amazons. That's a really good point.
Yes.
But putting that aside for a second and just talking about the Amazon angle here, I think the big question that we should ask ourselves when we look at this is the homeless situation that we're seeing in Seattle right now, which is just far and beyond, I think, what anybody would have ever predicted, the situation that we are in right now. If Amazon had not brought all of these people from the outside into our city, if Amazon had not created all of these very kind of high-paying jobs, not middle-class jobs, but very like kind of upper echelon high-paying jobs into our city, if you took Amazon out of the equation, do we think we would have the same homelessness crisis that we have today? And I think that the homelessness crisis is related directly to the changing economy of Seattle, which Amazon is responsible for. I don't want to punish Amazon. This isn't punitive. Taxes are not punitive. We're not trying to teach lessons. We're trying to say you've changed the fabric of our city in a very, very short amount of time that maybe to the city's discredit, it was not prepared for. And because of that, we have human beings and children living on the street. And that should be a priority for us right now, not necessarily whether or not Amazon has to pay its fair share.
Okay. Yeah. And that's a grand philosophy. And I think John's philosophy, just to kind of keep the balance in the show, is that business can do what business can do, and the impact of that business on society can be monitored by the city government. But if that's, are you telling me then that Seattle would be better off without the tech boom?
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that it's punitive. Okay. I'm just saying that, like, but we all pay taxes for a reason, and I understand why, and probably like a lot of, I'm probably out of step with a lot of your listeners, so I don't mean any disrespect, but I would guess that
just
probably a lot of the people listening right now are sick of taxes, right? They're sick of paying taxes. Well, I understand that. I actually can disagree with you, but I understand when it's hitting your pocketbook. I don't understand why there seems to be kind of a grassroots protectionism of Amazon. This won't hurt Amazon. I don't want to punish Amazon. I'm just saying we need to pay for we need to offset what Amazon has done to our city.
Okay, by the way, so let's just stick with Amazon. I didn't realize that we'd be zeroing in so much on Amazon, but this is good. I think it's fine. So here we talked to the newsroom, talked to Sarah Rankin, director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University, and she believes that companies like Amazon, like you've said, do have a responsibility to contribute to solving homelessness and should have followed the lead of a similar company in San Francisco.
I think it's fair to ask businesses that are contributing to the affordable housing crisis to take ownership. What I would have loved to have seen from Amazon is not waiting for the head tax to have to be imposed. It could have done something like Cisco did in Santa Clara. I don't remember the order of it, but it was something like $20, maybe $60 million. It was double digits, millions of dollars that Cisco pledged to support a specific group that was addressing homelessness in Santa Clara. Wonderful response from the community. So it got out ahead of it and said, you know what? We understand that we're contributing to the tight housing market. We want to be a player.
If you take that, point seriously, I think that's the argument that I would make in favor of a compromise at this point. I think it's true. Amazon has tried to make sort of inroads into helping the homeless issue. They took the one of the buildings that they were going to tear down for a future Amazon building wasn't going to be torn down for like 18 months, and so they turned it over to Mary's Place. And says, yeah, you can house women, unsheltered women, or women with children that are sort of on the run from abusive spouses and the like. That's what we want to encourage. It's kind of let's work together. And I think that what happened with the head tax is, Amazon and maybe Starbucks and the major corporations weren't brought in to the table soon enough for them to have to weigh in. I like to think that of Amazon and Starbucks and all these major corporations, Boeing obviously as well, as being good neighbors, and that they're businesses that do impact our society for the good and sometimes for the ill, that there be some kind of a balance. I think maybe because of all this brouhaha over the head tax, this isn't if Jeff Bezos and or Amazon is willing to get on board with this compromise, that might pave the way for a future where you actually have, you know, business working with the government to the benefit of everybody.
Yeah, I just feel like Amazon is sort of Pollyannish? Like no, I don't think it's Pollyannish, but the most negative thing about this whole story to me is how Amazon, and I know we're focusing in
sure,
on
but
this,
I mean,
but the fact that they pulled the tactic of we're pausing construction on this project, that to me is not we want a seat at the table. That is, we are going to bully you. Like, you've okay. now... You know what I was watching? Oh, you'll yeah. like this. You know what I was watching the other day, which I hadn't seen in years? Genevieve, yeah. my girlfriend, had it on. The original Alien movie.
Sure.
Right?
Okay.
And I feel like Amazon... Boy, this is an unflattering comparison. Can I pull out of this? No.
Yes.
You know how at a certain point the alien sticks itself on a human's face.
Right.
But then the human can only stay alive so long as that alien is stuck on his face.
Right.
I don't think that Amazon is a horrible alien that is trying to kill us and put his eggs in our belly.
Uh-huh.
Huh? Where'd I go with this? I like Amazon. I use Amazon.
Yes.
I'm a Prime member. I love Amazon. I want it to stay here and I want us to thrive. But it really turned negative to me when it pulled that, oh yeah, then maybe we'll pause this project.
Mm-hmm.
How you like me now, Seattle? Like, I don't think that, and I'm sure I find it really hard to believe that, that our city did not allow these companies to have input in the process. Companies always like to say, we don't have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
You're Amazon. You're Microsoft. You had a seat at the table if you wanted to. I don't know how responsive they were.
Okay, but if they really were trying to bully us as in the city of Seattle, then why wouldn't they go all the way? Why wouldn't they insist that, no head tax, period?
Or?
After all, the chance.
Or what?
No. I mean, or they would stop construction. But the idea is the fact that Amazon, if this is all true, and this is secondhand, we have not heard this from Amazon itself. We've heard this from the construction worker, labor union that had been advocating against the head tax, says Amazon called them directly and said we would unpause our pause if that was the case. So assuming that's the gospel truth, that seems like a goodwill gesture on the part of Amazon to say, we're willing to work with you, Seattle. We're not trying to bully you. You don't buy it.
Listen, I like the fact that we are talking about negotiating, and that is the way things are done.
Yeah.
And whether or not I sign on to Jenny Durkin's plan doesn't matter in the long run, but it is a negotiating tactic.
Sure.
Both sides are going to ask for extremes, and maybe you meet somewhere in the middle. The last thing I'll say on this, why not open a new can of worms while the music is playing? But it's also in the new plan where that money is directed. I think the core thing is we need to make sure that the money is earmarked for affordable housing.
Yeah, and that's the key. Jenny Durkin wants to do that with a whole bunch of other things, like a needle cleanup, because I think that's politically more palatable.
But I do think that if we get into that right now, I will never be asked here again. So let's just go to a break. You're listening to Tom and Curly on Cairo Radio. I'm Andrew Walsh in for John Curly today. Nobody ever wants to get old, right? But we should. Turns out age can bring happiness, which is, I guess, why Tom's been so giddy lately. Whoa! Age jokes. We're going to talk about that more in just a second here on Cairo Radio.
From depressed Andrew.
This Tom and Curly podcast is brought to you in part by Farrah.com. Sell your home without paying a listing commission. Farrah is a new way to sell your home. No listing commission and all the services, from an MLS listing to yard signs to pictures and more. Call Farrah at 1-800-571-FAIRA or go online to Farrah.com. Now, the Tom and Curly podcast.
This hour of the Tom and Curly Show is brought to you by Keel Mortgage. That's right, Keel Mortgage. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curly away today. He'll be back on Monday and filling in from Too Beautiful to Live, or TBTL podcast, the great Andrew Walsh.
Hey, man.
Stepping up this
Thanks
morning.
For having me. I haven't called you John, have I?
No,
yet? We've only been through
so.
One segment. That's always my biggest fear, because the names are very similar. John, that's, Tom, I'm sure you put up with that a lot.
That's quite all right. I have no problem with that. Right. And if I say Andrew, I've got 15 people responding to me in the studio.
Yeah, more on that
we're
later.
Yes, indeed. But first, there's this great article in The Guardian that Andrew Lanier found for us, our producer, with the headline, Life Gets Better After 50, Why Age Tends to Work in Favor of Happiness. And we thought, oh, this is perfect. We have a generational split here. I'm 63. You've just cleared 40, right, Andrew?
I'm 41, yeah.
So right now, the thesis of this article, and basically it's the article is based on a new book called The Happiness Curve, that, and I assume this is true for, they say they did these big studies, and this is universal in terms of international. In 55 of 80 countries, they study that this is indeed the case, that one satisfaction with life kind of dips in your 40s. You're on the precipice of that dip, unless you already are deeply ensconced in it. And so we're just wondering if we share these feelings. Here's the thesis of the book, that When you're about 20, you have the world ahead of you. You have super huge ambitions. You're going to change the world. One of the lines they said is, you're going to write something better than Shakespeare even wrote. I mean, your ambitions know no ends. By the time you hit 40 or in your 40s, I think the lowest, the nadir, they say, happens at 46. You know, if you're trying to put this on a graph, that by the time you're 40, whether you have been successful or unsuccessful, it just feels like, is that all there is kind of the idea that, okay, the author of this book says he was 40, he was very successful, he had succeeded beyond his expectations even, and yet he felt somehow dissatisfied. He felt like he was in kind of a funk, what was wrong with me, kind of going through a somewhat of a depression. I think I might be overstating it. But then in his 50s, he noticed there was a real kind of uptick. He's now in his, he's approaching 60, and he realized, if I'd only known when I was 40 that this is just natural to feel this way, I could have weathered it much better. And so that's why he's writing this book.
Because they say, you know, you're happy. Maybe you're even gaining in happiness up until 40. Then it dips down, like you just said. But then the interesting thing is from age 50 to 80.
Yes.
You don't just clear the valley there.
Increase
with happiness from age 50 to 80. So I assume like 80-year-olds are just like the happiest damn people in the world. I don't know what happens after 80. They ran out of money for the study.
Yeah, the steep decline.
Yeah.
No, yeah, they say, I think that you peak at 70, but then once you get to a certain
age. Oh, you peak at 70, not 80?
But you can hold that peak, you know, for the 70s, not till the 80s where, and that's a sort of an interesting philosophy about that. So I guess I want to ask you, my problem is, for me with this study, I've always been kind of an upbeat guy, and I don't, whatever troughs I've had have been, you know, shallow troughs, I think. Mm-hmm. That to me, the most hectic time, it was never sad time, but the most hectic time in my life where I felt like life was out of control was when I had two young kids. Sort of like what Andrew Lanier is starting to go through now, being a new father. That was the time that I felt like most, you know, kind of manic. But even then, it wasn't a depression.
It wasn't a depression. It was just probably pulling your hair out.
Exactly. Well, yeah just because you're spread too thin, you're doing too many too many things. So let's
this article. Can I just shift the focus? But
That's
interesting, because this article also points out that actually this sort of malaise, for lack of a better word, maybe it's not depression, but a malaise, it actually is not about being too spread out. It's actually a lack of challenges, sort of. Like when you're younger and you're like, oh, how am I going to tackle this kid problem? How am I going to tackle this new job problem? How am I going to do this? But then you're 40, it's like, crap, I got everything figured out.
Yeah, and somehow that lets you down. So I want to ask you, since you're 41, do you feel like you've got everything figured out, life is good, and that's what's wrong with life?
No, I don't even know where to begin with this.
Yes.
Because as a kid, growing up in high school, the idea of growing old to me was just catastrophic. And this is a very dark thing to say. And obviously it's ridiculous, but when I was in high school, I was obsessed with the idea that there was no point in living past 30. And I wasn't going around being morose about I was a kid. Yeah. I was an idiot. Yeah. I was just like a rebel. I don't know what it was. I was just all those things that you are when you're in high school and you think, this is it. This is the peak. You know, just the idea that, honestly, even the idea that like pop culture wouldn't be marketed towards me anymore felt like death, worse than death to me. And to the point where every birthday I talk to my mom and my mom's like, hey, you didn't kill yourself at 30. Way to go. Like, and that's a very dark way to go through life. But it wasn't about depression then. It was just about this idea that I wouldn't know what to do with myself if I was part of the olds. You know? Yet, looking at my personal life now, I haven't gone a traditional route, right? I don't have kids. I've been partnered up, but never got married.
Yeah.
Didn't go like the traditional, like kind of house in the suburbs kind of thing. We move around a lot. I live in a cool city.
Yeah.
But I would say that even though I have some worries that come along with age, such as health things, which are just starting to kind of pop up, no big deal, but little things that concern me, I can't think of another time that I would go back to. I hate looking at old photos of myself because I look at photos, I'm like, at the time this was taken, I thought I was so fat and bald. And I had no idea what the future held.
Now look at me.
I look like George Clooney in those damn photos, man.
I know.
And that like kills me. Yet, do I want to go back to where I was 5, 10 years ago? No, because things kind of keep getting better.
Oh, they
so
do.
Far,
okay, that's good.
But I'm only 41. I haven't hit the nadir yet.
Yeah. You've got a hell of a decade ahead of you.
We'll have to
check into more.
But what about you?
Well, the thing is, one of the things they say is that once you hit your 50s, you let go of regrets. And I don't feel that's the case at all. Right now, I am full of regrets, but they're life-affirming regrets, if that makes any sense.
Why did I ask Andrew to fill in today? Is that near the top?
Exactly. Believe me, I didn't ask. But the key for me here is now that I look back, so now my kids are grown. They're living on their own in New York. You know, they've got their own lives. Now I look back and feel like, oh, I should have been more active as a dad. Now, compared to my dad, who, you know, I was raised in the 50s and 60s, I was much more involved in my kids' lives. But now I go back and, you know, I sort of regret not being able to relive that moment. In fact, what's interesting to me about being now that I'm in my 60s, I would love to relive my entire life. The problem is my life has gone great, and if I relived it, it could have gone, you know, haywire so many different ways. But to me, the idea is, I think that why you feel happier in your 50s and maybe 60s and 70s, you appreciate life. Maybe it's mortality. I remember when no birthday had an impact on me until I was 60. And then at 60, I go, man, it's impossible for me to convince anyone else that I feel young. I was in my 50s, I felt like, oh, prime of life even. Mm-hmm. When you get into your 60s, then you realize how many more years, you know, so even if I get to live to be 80, that's like I only got 20 more years left.
Yeah.
And because of that, you start relishing how great life is that you have right now. And that, I think, there's an upswing. By the way, not to make too light of this, but in the 50s, if life isn't going well for you, it's kind of a crutch. If life is going well for you, then you can go through this malaise. A lot of people are having a tough life, and they can't afford to kind of reflect philosophically about things. And we need to take that into account. Because there are a lot of suicides for people in their 50s, too, when they feel like life is passing by and I've got nothing to go for.
Yeah, this conversation that you and I just had is definitely the result of a lot of privilege, I think, and a lot of luck as well. We should acknowledge that for sure. Okay. The most interesting part of that whole story that I learned is that you're only in your 60s. Oh, man, why am I making age jokes? I never do that off the air, yet I'm playing this character. I don't know. It must be something about sitting in this chair. You are listening to the Tom and Curly Show. I'm Andrew Walsh, in for John today. Speaking of my name, Andrews, Tom just mentioned we have three of them here in the studio today. Tom is oddly obsessed with this fact. So we're going to talk about the fact that we're all Andrews, no Andys, no Drews, and the power of names. That's coming up in just a second here on Cairo Radio.
Hi, I'm Tina Sorensen, General Sales Manager for Cairo Radio. When Tom and Curly fans miss their favorite show, they pull it up on demand. Maybe you should advertise here. Make sure you're reaching your customers anywhere they listen. Give me a call and I'll help you out. 206-726-6819.
Hey, how come Andrew gets to get up?
That's right.
If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy.
That's a clip from Andrew Walsh's favorite movie, The Breakfast Club.
It used to be up there. It used to be up there, certainly.
And we're going to be talking about the significance of that clip in just a second. But first, I've got to remind people, don't forget, in the 11 o'clock hour, we're going to play the Know-It-All Quiz, brought to you by Muckleshoot Bingo. And today, someone's going to win two tickets to the May 18th performance of Seattle Opera's Aida. By the way, I've seen this production. It's fantastic. Showcasing Verdi's power to translate human emotions into magnificent music. Find tickets today at seattleopera.org or win the Know-It-All Quiz coming up at 11:30. John Curley is going to write and send us the questions momentarily, I am sure.
Your voice is sounding more desperate every time. I'm sure
John won't let us down. If he doesn't send it, I'm going to forever hammer him for his unreliability. But the reason we probably already forgotten that great Breakfast Club clip about Andrew, but I noted last night when I found out that Andrew Walsh was going to be my co-host today, I said, son of a gun, we are having an entire studio full of Andrews. We have Andrew Walsh at the microphone. We have Andrew Lanier as our producer, and we have Andrew Enzel. Okay.
That's very respectful. Why would you figure that out ahead of time? He's only your colleague. I'm just joking. I don't know why I'm being so mean to you.
I think it is the John chair.
This is why I usually sleep late. It turns out I'm a jerk in the morning.
That's right. So anyway, we have three Andrews, and the weird thing is, as you pointed out in the tease, none of you go by Andy, which is like the go-to diminutive of that word, and I just thought, it'd be funny to talk about being an Andrew, whether you like it or not, what the significance of it is. Are you embarrassed or proud of your name? And the like.
I worked hard to earn this Andrew, man. I grew up as an Andy.
You did?
Yes. If I called my dad on the phone right now on speakerphone, he would answer the phone, Andy boy. That's how he would say it. Everybody called me Andy growing up. Okay. And then I switched schools in eighth grade and I was like, this is my moment. I'm not going to be a nerd anymore. And I'm going to start by telling everybody my name is, I think, Drew is what I wanted to go.
Oh, so you
wanted
to be Drew. Okay.
I go to my very first class. I go to the homeroom. And, you know, there was only like two classes. It wasn't actual junior high. And my homeroom teacher introduces me to the class as Andy. Like, I made a point of telling him that my name was Andrew. I did everything I could. I had been looking forward all summer to turning into an Andrew when I showed up for school. And the teacher just, with one quick introduction, whoomp, I was Andy, and I was a nerd all year.
So what does being called Andrew mean to you?
I don't know. For some reason, and this is my own personal baggage, because there's tons of people who are a million times cooler than me, obviously, whose names are Andy. But for me, I was like a really nerdy, bullied kid, and part of that was the fact that I had this like kind of wimpy name, Andy, and I thought that being an Andrew would be better. But let's hear these guys weigh in.
Okay,
what about you guys?
Andrew Lanier, do you like your name? How do you feel about your name?
Well, first of all, I mean, if there's ever a missed name for anyone, it would be all three of us here, because the name actually means strong and manly.
Oh,
as a wimpy, bullied, nerdy kid.
My God.
That's pretty rough. But I don't know. It's just kind of a soft-sounding name. There's no hard consonants.
Were you ever an Andy?
No. I'm 5'6", so I don't need any more diminutives.
Okay.
If someone was to choose like a radio nom de plume, you'd never choose Andrew. You'd choose something with a strong set, like Mike.
Yeah.
Jim,
right?
Stuart,
Thunder.
Okay, and let's go to Andrew Enzel. Andrew, how do you feel about your name? Were you ever an Andy? Are you proud of your name? Embarrassed by your name? If you could change it, would you?
I used to be an Andy, similar to your situation, where I grew up as an Andy until like fourth grade, when I was just like, I want to be Andrew now. And my parents, I remember when I talked with my parents about it, they're like, I kept saying Andy, and I was like, oh shoot, no, it's Andrew. But I just decided in fourth grade, I'm like, I want to be an Andrew now, and that went over relatively well. But people do, when I introduce myself to people, they will still like sometimes nickname me as Andy or Drew, which sometimes I'll fight them, but sometimes I'll just go with it and like, fine, you know, this one or two people are going to call me Drew or Andy, and that's fine. But I feel similar about Andy, where it sounds more to me like a kid's name. Where Andrew sounds more like an adult's name.
Like, I can think of the personalities for all three names, sort of. I think Andy is, like, unflinchingly happy, like, almost Canadian.
Like, just picture the most stereotypical kind of happy-go-lucky Canadian.
Like Andy
maybe
Griffith's
Andy.
The only Andy
maybe
I can
with
think
red
of.
Hair. I feel yeah. like I get a okay. red hair
like
vibe
Opie.
From it, right? Andrew is like us, somewhat more like kind of studious, I think.
Yeah.
And slightly more formal in a certain yeah. way. And Drew is the cool guy, man. Drew came skateboarding in. He did one of those little high kick things so he could catch his skateboard in one hand. And he wears his baseball cap backwards.
So clearly none of you are Drews.
No. If you're going to choose a nickname for yourself, you could go with no better nickname than Tommunist.
That's Tommunist. Right. I know. I would never go by Thomas. You guys are too formal. Relax. You're all Andes to me.